Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue our analysis of a recent book which details the framing of O.J. Simpson. Beyond that, this particular book talks about the very strong probability that the members of the Los Angeles legal system, from police right on up to members of the criminologist laboratory, who were involved in the framing of O.J. Simpson may very well have been of neo-Nazi outlook, and in fact perhaps some of them actual members of Nazi or white supremacist groups, although no firm allegation is presented in that particular regard. We should note, however, that is to say, no firm allegation is presented linking them to a particular group. As noted, the Newsweek magazine issue from the last week of March of 1995 contains an article in which fellow officers of Furman allege that he was the de facto head of a white supremacist group within the Los Angeles Police Department called WASP, or White Anglo-Saxon Policemen. These allegations, again, presented by Newsweek as coming from the LAPD personnel files that Judge Lance Ito would not permit to be introduced into evidence. Bear in mind, by the way, that Ito's wife, Peggy York, was the highest-ranking member of the Los Angeles Police Department and at one point was Mark Furman's watch commander. This book is entitled Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. The book was authored by Stephen Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, published in softcover by Dove Books, Dove Audio, and the ISBN number is 0-7871-0863-4. And Stephen Singular is described on the back of the book, a Denver-based journalist whose first book, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, became the basis for the 1989 Oliver Stone film Talk Radio. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller A Killing in the Family and Charmed to Death. This particular book features information presented to Stephen Singular by an unnamed source highly placed within the Los Angeles legal system who was appalled at the way things took place. Beyond that, as noted in the preface of the book, the individual who became Singular's informant contacted Singular specifically because of Singular's role in writing about the neo-Nazi killing of Alan Berg. In Legacy of Deception, Stephen Singular talks about the difficulty that he had in getting people to accept the possibility that white supremacist elements within LAPD may have been involved with framing O.J. Simpson. And I would point out that in this book, very, very compelling evidence that, in fact, O.J. Simpson was framed is presented. It's an incredibly important book, although it does not go as far as I would have liked to have seen it go. I think there is much work yet to be done. Yet, with regard to the framing of O.J. Simpson, this book is the definitive work. It says a lot about this society that even though O.J. Simpson was acquitted, people still believe that he is guilty of committing two murders, which, in fact, he obviously did not commit. He was framed, and this book, Legacy of Deception, talks about how he was framed, and beyond that points strongly in a direction as to who did the framing. And again, I would note the recently concluded series Specialized Knowledge and Abilities that talks about Nazi and white supremacist tactics of infiltrating the police and military in order to gain specialized knowledge and abilities in order to overthrow the system. That appears to be what took place here. And rereading a short section of the preface, I'd been told precisely how and why Detective Mark Furman had planted evidence against Simpson. I'd been told what the legal system had done in response to Furman's actions and how the media and the American public had been terribly misled. I would interject that there has never been any objective legal finding on these allegations. I would also stress that the evidence presented in this book does point strongly in that direction, but simply for legal purposes, we should note, even though O.J. Simpson has had his legal rights sorely abused, Mark Furman has never been charged with any crime, and it has never been proven that Mark Furman did what he is alleged to have done here, hence my use of the term allegation. Continuing, it is, however, very compellingly documented in this book that O.J. Simpson was framed, and it certainly appears as if Furman was involved. My personal feeling vis-a-vis the O.J. Simpson case is that it was a domestic intelligence operation. It would not surprise me if Furman himself was used as a patsy if if my speculation concerning the possibility of the O.J. case as a domestic intelligence operation, specifically a type of operation known as a PSYOP, is correct, then it may well be that Furman himself, because of his racist views and also because of the tapes that he had been making for 10 years with Laura Hart McKinney, may very well have been manipulated himself. He also, to a certain extent, may be something of a victim, although he also may very well have helped frame O.J. Simpson. Again, about why Singular's source picked him. My initial meeting with my source lasted about 30 minutes. On later occasions, I would be told many other things. The most disturbing piece of information concerned the first book I'd written, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg. This book, which became the basis of Oliver Stone's 1988 movie Talk Radio, chronicled the assassination of a talk show host in Denver by a small band of neo-Nazis from Washington State. The killers were members of a fringe group known as the Order, who had decided to start a white power revolution by murdering Jews, African Americans, and other minorities. Their first Jewish target, gunned down in June of 1984, was Berg. Now, in the fall of 1994, I was being told that neo-Nazis were no longer operating just on the edges of American society, but had moved closer to the mainstream. In some cases, they were inside the system itself, and they had become deeply disruptive. Initially, I had difficulty seeing how any of this was connected to the O.J. Simpson case. Why was I being given information about a double homicide that had occurred several states away from my home in Denver? And what was I, a total outsider to the Los Angeles legal system, supposed to do with all this? For months, almost nothing made sense. And again, skipping well into the book, after attempting, Singular chronicles next is the extreme difficulty he had in convincing media people that, in fact, Nazi-slash-white supremacist elements may have framed O.J. Simpson. The first reference here is to, skipping down a little bit into this book. Who was going to find out the truth about Detective Furman's racial views or look into the kind of police activities in which he may have been involved in the past? Who was going to prove or disprove the allegation raised in the winter of 1995 that he'd left a swastika in the locker of another policeman, an allegation brought forward not by an outsider or by someone working for the defense, but by Lucian Coleman, an employee in the L.A. District Attorney's Office? If the judicial system was not interested in answering these questions, I assumed a large news organization would have a different attitude. But when I suggested to representatives from two television networks that Furman may have had ties to white supremacist groups or beliefs, this idea was met with incredulity. They acted as if I were a shill for the defense team. When I said that the murder investigation should be reopened and other leads should be followed, this concept was met with something akin to scorn. All of these people knew who had killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. Why was I wasting their time? In May, I proposed working for a couple of the networks on a short-term basis, perhaps 30 days. They had more resources than I did. I had some information that I thought might be significant, and thus far I'd shared it with no one in the media. Together, I thought we might pursue it and see where it led. One television executive flew from L.A. to Denver on a Friday night, and we had dinner at the Ship's Tavern restaurant in the Brown Palace Hotel. The day before I met with him, NBC News had reported the defense's claim that two blood drops, one at the condo and another one on some socks found in Simpson's bedroom, contained EDTA. During a lengthy phone conversation, I told this executive about my involvement with the blood preservative issue, and that involvement was apparently one reason he decided to change his weekend flight plans and come to Denver. While we ate, amateur lounge singers performed loud, dreadful renditions of Hello, Dolly! And One. The executive bought me drinks and pumped me for more details about the Simpson case. At his request, I gave him my book proposal, some other pieces of information, and copies of my phone bills to show him that I had indeed talked to the defense team scores of times last summer and fall. I also mentioned my first book and described how my research into the neo-Nazi movement had led me to write about the murders of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. As the hours passed, he pressed me harder. I told him he should think about a tangential connection between the recent bombing in Oklahoma City and the O.J. Simpson case. Was it possible that the white supremacist beliefs I'd documented 10 years ago were now surfacing in both disaffected ex-soldiers and disruptive police officers? Was it possible that one man with a bomb and a copy of the Turner Diaries could kill 169 people? Or that one cop operating on a false assumption could hold an entire legal system hostage for nearly a year now? Were both of these things variations on the theme of domestic terrorism? Weren't we seeing the emergence of social problems that went far beyond the Simpson case? Weren't we watching and feeling all around us the racial divisions angers, and fears that still tormented America. Was it conceivable that police attitudes and behavior were adding to the violence that all of us were afraid of? I told him he should think about something the homicide detectives in Los Angeles had never seriously pondered. Maybe Nicole Simpson was not the target of this crime, as Mark Furman and almost everyone else had always assumed. Maybe the time had come to think about other options and to widen the scope of the investigation. Maybe there were people and leads in Los Angeles that had never been pursued. Maybe his network would be interested in looking into this. He listened with great interest, and at one point he even seemed on the verge of acknowledging that there might be something to what I was telling him. He said he would take my information back to New York, where he was based, and use it to convince his superiors to work with me. He would have an answer, he indicated, early next week. My experience with him turned out to be similar to my experience with others who worked for major media outlets. I never heard from him again. I never heard that he checked out what I was saying and found it to be false or absurd. I never heard that he'd come to the conclusion that I'd been misled. I never heard anything. He took everything I gave him, and he never called back. When I phoned him, he did not return my calls. Why? Because, in my opinion, he simply didn't want to think about these things anymore. He didn't want to consider that police officers might hold political views that are fundamentally dangerous to all of us. He didn't want to think about other scenarios for the crimes that were different from the one he'd already embraced. He, or his bosses, did not want to be disturbed by any new stimuli. Indeed, I think that the experience that Stephen Singular had in attempting in vain to alert people to what was going on in many ways recapitulates the experience that I have had in attempting to alert people to the onset of fascism in the United States. And by the way, I don't want to be misunderstood. Obviously, I'm quoting Singular's text here. I don't want to be misunderstood as implying that most or even all police officers hold racist or Nazi views. That obviously is not the case, or things would be far worse than they are now. However, a great many of them do. And also note again the aforementioned tactic of acquiring specialized knowledge and abilities for the overthrow of the state by infiltrating the police and militaries, that tactic actively being practiced by white supremacists. In the passage I read you, you heard references to an assistant district attorney in the Los Angeles DA's office, a woman named Lucien Coleman, a 17-year veteran of the DA's office, by the way, and not someone whom one would expect to assist the defense. She brought Furman's racist past and the distinct possibility that Furman may be a Nazi to the attention of Marcia Clark within approximately a week of the killings. Marcia Clark, by the way, one of Ms. Magazine's Women of the Year, chose to do nothing with this information. Stephen Singular writes of this development as follows. One afternoon, while the Furman tapes were being played in the courtroom, a woman called the talk radio station in Denver that had been broadcasting the trial live. Her name was Pauline, and she told a story that stopped the program cold. She said that she'd been in the official Marine Corps typist at Furman's discharge hearing at California's Camp Pendleton back in the mid-1970s, and she claimed to have typed up documents stating that Furman had been accused of painting swastikas on the lockers of black soldiers. According to this woman, he had also been accused of taking a group of mostly African-American soldiers into the California desert and marching them so long and so hard that one young man had died. The only reason that Furman was not given a dishonorable discharge, Pauline explained, was because his superiors had protected him. The radio station asked a private investigator to find this woman and attempt to verify her story. The PI, Billy Perea of Boulder, Colorado, made numerous phone calls to Pauline, but she refused to speak to him about the matter, apparently afraid of being dragged into the Simpson case. I contacted Perea, again P-E-R-E-A, and also tried to interview Pauline, but was unsuccessful. I called Camp Pendleton and was referred to the National Personnel Research Center in St. Louis, where Furman's military file is kept, but the center would not provide access to this document. In Furman's LAPD personnel file, he had mentioned his military service telling another psychiatrist, Dr. Ronald Kegler, K-O-E-G-L-E-R, that he'd stopped enjoying his Marine Corps duty because, quote, "There were these Mexicans and niggers, volunteers, and they would tell me they weren't going to do something," unquote. Although Pauline's claims are hard to prove, a number of things took place within the LAPD in the late 1980s that may lend credence to some of what she said on the radio. These events also appear to substantiate one of the key things I told the defense team about a personal connection between Furman and Nicole Simpson in August of 1994 at my first meeting with Carl Douglas in Shapiro's office. By the way, there were allegations presented to Stephen Singular by his source within the L.A. legal system, and this apparently also was carried in a scuttlebutt that was kicked around within the LAPD, that Mark Furman had a sexual relationship with Nicole Simpson at one point. More about that later. The event surfaced after that, returning to Stephen Singular's text. The event surfaced after the Furman tapes were aired in public, when it was revealed that the LAPD had conducted an internal affairs investigation of the detective in February of 1995. According to the report that came out of this investigation, in August or September of 1994, two detectives, Walter Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y, and David Lamkin, L-A-M-B-K-I-N, were in the L.A. Criminal Courts building where they'd come to file a case. They saw Deputy District Attorney Lucian Coleman, whom they'd known for years in the hallway, along with another Deputy D.A., Julie Sergojian, S-E-R-G-O-J-I-A-N. Coleman approached Purdy and said, "Hey, have you heard the latest thing the defense is trying to pull?" After telling Purdy that the Simpson defense team was alleging Furman had planted a bloody glove at the defendant's estate, Coleman laughed. Purdy looked at her very seriously and said, "I wouldn't put anything past him," unquote. Coleman was taken aback by his response because she'd regarded the allegation as a joke. During the same conversation, the report states, Purdy told Sergojian and Coleman about an incident that occurred in 1987 while he was assigned to the West Los Angeles station. Coleman understood that Purdy married a Jewish woman. When Purdy came back from his honeymoon, he found numerous swastika insignias painted on the inside of his locker at West Los Angeles Station. Purdy told them that Furman's fingerprints were found on the inside of his locker. Sergojian was walking through the hallway when Coleman told her to stop and to listen to something. Purdy stated that the matter had been investigated with fingerprints and photographs taken. Furman was determined to be responsible, based on his fingerprints being inside the locker. Furman received either a reprimand or some days off, unquote. While they were talking, Coleman also heard Purdy call Furman a Nazi. Captain Alan Deal, D-E-A-L, and Sergeant Jim Wakefield, W-A-K-E-F-I-E-L-D, looked into this matter and, according to the report, concluded that, quote, Furman may or may not have been responsible, as there was no evidence to identify a suspect. The locker incident was not racially motivated, unquote. Furman himself, when interviewed for the investigation, denied ever placing a swastika insignia or any other item on Purdy's locker. Again, bear in mind that according to what Purdy initially told the assistant DA, Furman's fingerprints were found inside of the locker. This later was denied as what appears to have been a circling of the wagons, that exact phrase used in an LAPD article about this incident. A circling of the wagons by LAPD occurred. Quote, "He did not remember such an incident occurring," the report states. Furman heard a decal of a, quote, D blank 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 was placed on Purdy's locker while he was working. Furman was told the decal was 4 to 5 inches in diameter, depicting a drawing of a human penis or of some type and the words D blank 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 head. He interpreted the event as a prank or someone's attempt to tell Purdy his attitude was poor, unquote. A week or so after their discussion in the criminal courts building, Lucian Coleman spoke with Purdy again. Purdy told her about a log he'd kept while assigned to WLA, that's West Los Angeles, from 1986 to 1989. Coleman understood that the log contained specific information about Furman's activities during this period of time. According to the report in June or July of 1994, another deputy DA, Ellen Burke, talked to a detective who'd heard something about Nicole Simpson and Mark Furman. The detective, the report says, heard the story from someone who had been at a party with Furman. Furman had bragged he had seen Nicole's, quote, boob job, unquote. The party was some kind of non-LAPD event and was not a barbecue. Burke concluded from the detective's remarks that Nicole Simpson and Furman had been lovers. Coleman heard the same story from another detective from the 77th Division. Sergojian learned of the story in October or November of 1994. Sergojian walked into the adjacent office where Deputy D.A. Ellen Burke worked. Burke, B-U-R-K-E, related another story about an officer who had spoken with Furman at a barbecue some years back. The officer had been at a barbecue for West Los Angeles officers with Furman. Furman stated that he had seen Nicole Brown Simpson's new, and again the phrase, B-blank-blank-blank job. Furman indicated that he saw the breast augmentation, quote, up close and personal, unquote. When questioned about this in February of 1995, Furman, the report says, quote, denied any knowledge regarding the subject matter, unquote. In late summer of 1994, the report states, Lucian Coleman agonized over what to do with the information about the locker incident and the Furman Nicole stories. She, quote, finally went to Deputy DAs Marcia Clark and Bill Hodgman. The meeting with Clark, Hodgman, and Coleman occurred in September of 1994. Coleman believed she had an ethical duty to report the information as it should be released to the defense. Clark discounted the matter and alleged the information was being sent out by the defense. Coleman advised Clark that she was hearing the information from officers and not the defense. Clark became upset and told Coleman she was tired of other DDAs trying to get involved in the Simpson case. By the way, she later, in the L.A. Times, in an article about this, she described this as, quote, it's BS, unquote. Again, that's Marcia Clark, one of Ms. Magazine's Women of the Year for 1995. And she knew of this information within roughly a week of the killings. Continuing. On February 13th, 1995, Coleman was called by Hodgman at home. Hodgman told Coleman that the rumors had moved about the office and had reached the chief deputy's office. Hodgman wanted the name of the detective that had discussed the swastika incident. Coleman told Hodgman she wanted to discuss the matter with the concerned detective prior to giving Hodgman the information. Coleman called Purdy on February 13, 1995, at Hollywood Station. Coleman told Purdy about Hodgman's remarks. Purdy told Coleman there was nothing to worry about. He had his story straight, and there was no paperwork or investigation. Purdy did not believe the division's commanding officer involved in the incident would remember it. Coleman told Purdy that Hodgman knew about the log he had kept on Furman and other things as well. Purdy told Coleman that he had destroyed the log. On February 14, 1995, at 1,000 hours, Purdy telephoned Coleman and asked her if she was kidding him about the Internal Affairs Division investigation. Coleman assured Purdy she was not. Purdy reassured Coleman he would deny her remarks. Coleman told Purdy he had a, quote, big problem with the district attorney's office because there are two district attorneys who think you said something different to them, unquote. Coleman stated that she and Marcia Clark were good friends at one time. They and their husbands used to socialize together after work up until the incident involving the rumors Coleman passed on to Clark. Since that time, their relationship has cooled significantly. Coleman felt that Hodgman and Clark did not handle the information she provided them in an ethical manner. Coleman believed that Clark and Hodgman should have investigated the matter immediately. Had it been properly investigated, everyone's memory would have been fresh, and the truth of the matter would have been more easily learned. Purdy was also questioned by Internal Affairs, the report says, and during this inquiry, he mentioned his conversation with Coleman in the criminal courts building in the summer of 1994. The subject of Nicole Simpson and Furman also came up on that occasion. Purdy, the document says, questioned Coleman if Furman admitted to seeing Nicole's breasts naked. Coleman replied, well, I don't know. The guy that I talked to said that he overheard Furman say that he'd seen them. Coleman continued, and don't you think that sounds a little suspicious? That maybe he has some motive to plant the glove on O.J., knowing full well that he has these domestic problems? That if he was intimate with her, he would plant the glove on him? Purdy replied, boy, we're pushing it, Lucian. And skipping down in the story. Actually, let's just continue with the text. In February of 1995, while all these matters were being investigated, the report says that, quote, Purdy questioned Coleman as to the reason for the investigation. Coleman stated that Purdy's remarks would be exculpatory evidence that would be released to the Simpson defense. Purdy told Coleman that she was blowing the story out of proportion. Purdy told Coleman he did not have specific evidence that Furman was a racist. Coleman became quite agitated, stating, quote, This is an example of the code of silence, by the way, with a capital C and a capital S. Purdy denied changing his account or attempting to cover for another officer, unquote. By the way, this assistant district attorney maintains that he did. That same month, the report states, quote, Purdy's wife came across her husband's log while looking through some papers, preparing to pay their property taxes. His wife found the journal described as a bound book measuring 4 by 5 inches. Purdy's wife showed him the journal and asked him if that was what he was looking for. Purdy took the diary and threw it into the fireplace where it was destroyed. Purdy did not want to get involved in the, quote, case from hell, unquote. When Deputy District Attorney Julie Sergosian was interviewed during the investigation, she confirmed what Coleman had told the investigators about Purdy's remarks in the criminal courts building in August or September of 1994. Sergosian, the report says, questioned Purdy about the matter of his locker. Purdy stated that the matter had been investigated with fingerprints and photographs taken. Furman was found responsible for the incident based on his fingerprints being found inside the locker. Purdy continues stating Furman was very interested in Nazi memorabilia and had a Nazi uniform. Furman supposedly belonged to some type of Nazi collector's club, unquote. I would also indicate that Furman's attorney indicated that the Nazi insignia that he'd had was an editorial cartoon by Paul Conrad, the editorial cartoonist for the L.A. Times, called Out of the Ashes, which showed the German eagle with a swastika in its claws rising up out of the ashes, the indications being this from 1992, that once again Nazism was reemerging in Germany. By the way, there's a series that I did on that called Reunited Germany, the New Danger, and as Paul Conrad noted in some commentary in the Los Angeles Times, it was unclear whether, if in fact Furman had this particular editorial cartoon, how he felt about this particular matter. Again, unfortunately, according to the report, or according to information presented by the deputy DAs, the log that Purdy had about this incident was destroyed. Please note, however, that this information was presented to Marcia Clark by fellow deputy district attorneys, by people within the district attorney's office, hardly people that one would expect on the surface to have actively aided the defense. We're going to continue with our analysis of Legacy of Deception, an investigation of Mark Furman and racism in the LAPD, in our next segment. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.